In 1796, President George Washington and First Lady Martha Washington lived in the nation's capital, then Philadelphia. Washington's presidency would end the next year, and the first family were making plans to return to their Mount Vernon estate. The Washingtons owned slaves, and they'd planned to return to Virginia with the slaves they'd held at the president's mansion. But 22-year-old Ona Judge didn't want to return to Virginia. She wanted her freedom. So in May 1796, Judge escaped the Washingtons. She found her way to New England and made a place for herself in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. The Washingtons, though, they pursued Judge, but never captured her. However, it wasn't for want of trying, because in the waning days of his presidency, Washington used the full force of the federal government to try to return her to slavery, but he failed. And he continued to pursue Judge, unsuccessfully, until his death. Historian Erica Armstrong Dunbar tells this story in her new book, Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge. Dunbar is a professor of Black Studies and History at the University of Delaware, and when I spoke with her recently, I asked her to tell us more about Ona Judge.
Ona was one of hundreds of enslaved people who were born or brought to Mount Vernon. She, I think important to note is that she was technically the property of Martha Washington. Mm-hmm. Her mother had come from Martha Washington's first husband's estate. And so Martha Washington came to Mount Vernon, brought Ona's mother, Betty, with her. And Betty would go on to have some kind of encounter or relationship with a white indentured servant named Andrew Judge, and their encounter resulted in the birth of Ona. And Ona was born at Mount Vernon at the age of 10. She went up to the mansion house to serve Martha Washington and sort of moves up in the ranks and becomes basically Martha Washington's top slave.
Mm.
And she would also sort of take on the responsibilities of being a seamstress and a spinner, but she would do the most kind of intimate chores, helping Martha Washington bathe, brush her hair, fix her clothing. She knew her mistress well.
Yeah. Well, in 1789, after George Washington becomes president, the first president, you write in your book that Martha actually reluctantly joins him in the then first capital, which was New York. We're changing capitals a lot here in the early days of the country. What was that reluctance all about?
Yeah, she was. She referred to her days in the North actually as the lost days. She'd shared her husband with the nation for years during the American Revolution, and she worried about George Washington's health, and she didn't want to leave Virginia. She wanted to stay, and so she had no kind of control over her ability to stay. And so Washington actually goes to his own inauguration alone.
Huh. Well, I guess maybe what I should have asked more specifically is, given that they were slave owners, both in New York, but maybe especially in Philadelphia, things are complicated regarding Philadelphia as a city and slavery. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there were differences clearly between New York and Philadelphia, and I think the Washingtons really kind of run into a roadblock with slavery when they come to Philadelphia. The nation's capital moves again in 1790, and the Washingtons take 9 enslaved people with them to Philly. And the laws of Pennsylvania say that you can't hold an enslaved person there. If you're a non-resident, you can't bring your slaves with you for longer than 6 months. And if you do, they have the opportunity to find freedom. So George and Martha and their secretary, Tobias Lear, purposefully rotate their slaves in and out of Pennsylvania. They write to each other that they want to keep it discreet. So he's not actually breaking the law, but he's definitely breaking the spirit of the law. So he would rotate Ona Judge and her other enslaved companions every 6 months back to Virginia or to New Jersey if a trip to Virginia was too difficult.
Now, when Ona was in Philly, do we know if she saw firsthand? There were free blacks living in the city at the time.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, Philadelphia was the epicenter for black freedom and had more free blacks than anywhere else. Yeah, she saw it in the streets. She saw black entrepreneurs. She saw Richard Allen building Mother Bethel Church around the corner. There was no way to keep her from that. She saw it.
I mean, I cannot imagine the, I don't even know what to call it, the internal conflict, crisis, sense of out, what do you call it when you know you are being kept an enslaved person, and you see the possibility of your liberation just right there on the street every day when you leave the house with the person who's your owner.
Yeah, I think that it shows the complexity of slavery, right? It's that Ona Judge would live 7 years in the North and really came of age at this moment from the age of 16 to really 22 or so. And she sees black freedom around her. She also sees white men and women being paid a wage. So there's a wage labor system that's now in place. And it affects her, and it makes her, it helps pull the trigger on her decision to free herself, or at least to steal herself from the Washingtons.
Wow. And so when and how did she decide then to pursue her freedom?
She finds out that she's going to be given away. She's going to be given away as a wedding gift to Martha Washington's granddaughter, a woman who was about the same age and who was known for having a kind of volcanic temper. And that decision, that change in her ownership, in addition to her experiences in a free North, made Ona make the decision, I just cannot stomach my enslavement anymore. And she turns to a free black community in Philadelphia for help.
Yeah. Wow. And how does she make her way to Portsmouth then?
Yeah, so she luckily for us, Ona leaves behind two interviews at the end of her life. And she tells us in these interviews that it's the free black community of Philadelphia that helps plan her trip. She says while the Washingtons were packing their things to go on their summer trip, she was packing her things to go too. She didn't know where. But eventually the free black community would help her. She doesn't give names because it's a federal crime to help or aid a fugitive slave. The only name she gives us is the name of the ship captain, John Bowles, who I was able to trace his ship into the port of Philadelphia in May of 1796. She gives us his name in her interview because he's deceased. She tells us that they were the ones, that it's the free black community and John Bowles who ferries her to freedom or a semblance of freedom in Portsmouth.
Mm. There's so much more I want to cover with you, and we're fast running out of time. I'm getting greedy now. But, you know, it's easy to at a distance to try to paint a life of in freedom as one of a grand transformation of that's so much better. And, of course, by definition, it has to be better because she was no longer enslaved. But was her life any easier in Portsmouth?
Yeah, I think it's actually, I mean, a decision not to use the term free or freedom in the title of the book. The book is called Never Caught for a reason, because Ona was actually never free.
Okay.
And what the book does is dismantle this myth about what freedom in the North supposedly was. Ona would live for half of a century as a fugitive, constantly looking over her shoulder and really forced to live a life of poverty and great hardship. But she says in her interviews, she would do it all again, that it was worth it, that the material goods meant nothing.
So tell me more about this, you know, half a century living as a fugitive. And for much of that time, or part of that time at least, I mean, it's the president of the United States who's using all that's at his disposal in terms of the power of the federal government to chase her.
Yeah, he turns to the Secretary of the Treasury. He turns to customs collectors in Portsmouth. And all of this, by the way, is documented by Washington's own hand. So this is me using his words.
And so what does he say?
He says, go get her. He says, you know, my wife is very desirous of seeing her again. And I'd like you, we're going to do this under the most discreet, quiet manner possible. Go get her, and for as little cost as possible as well. And what's so interesting here is that it's a moment where George Washington clearly does break the law. He breaks the fugitive slave law, which set into action a process, a procedure in returning the enslaved who were fugitives. Lawyers and magistrates were to be involved, and Washington wanted none of that.
Hmm. And this is a pursuit that he maintained until he died.
Pretty much. I mean, he dies unexpectedly in December of 1799. We have correspondence that says up until September, he's still pursuing her.
Wow. So, but did his death then then proffer Ona true freedom?
No, it doesn't, because the thing to remember is that Ona was actually the property of Martha Washington.
Yeah.
And while we know that George Washington emancipates his slaves in his will following the death of Martha, Martha sets no one free. So none of the property passed down from her first husband to her grandchildren or anyone she bought outright was ever free. So while Ona would have known that the president had died, she also knew that it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. It did not set her free. And so even though we have not come across accounts of people going after her, she lived with the understanding that she was someone else's property, and any children that she had were also fugitives.
Historian Erica Armstrong Dunbar's new book is Never Caught: The Washingtons' Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave, Ona Judge.